morning. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our fourth case for the February sitting. And we have a special welcome to two groups that are with us today. First, we have students from Oconomowoc High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. We also have interns from the Department of Justice. Would they please stand? Are you all from law schools? How many are from Marquette? How many from UW? Any from other law schools? Well, we welcome you all to, wait a minute, what division are you with? All divisions? Are you with the criminal division? Civil? I'm at a loss. What other divisions are there?
Environment.
That's civil. Okay.
Try criminal appeals.
Criminal. Well, I ask criminal, so that's criminal appeals.
They all get A's, straight A's.
No, I'm not going to ask if you all get straight A's. You all do very well. You may be seated. You didn't come here to be harassed, so thank you. The high school students are with us with a program, a national award-winning program, cleverly entitled Court with Class. And the students are invited to come to an oral argument. If the school accepts the invitation, students are given materials about the case we are about to hear, and they may engage in some activities related to the case. In any event, they come to the court, they listen to oral argument, and after the oral argument, a member of the court, who is assigned by the court, speaks with the students that day, and the discussion relates to the procedures for accepting a case and deciding a case. The discussion is not about the substantive issues of law in the case. And everyone is invited to join the students in that discussion. Now, I have to ask, are you all prepared to stay right after this case for the students? Is that what your schedule does?
Yes.
Okay. If anyone would like a summary of the case you're about to hear, would you raise your right hand, and the marshal will give you a summary. All right. While that's happening, or it's not happening, as the case may be, let me introduce the court to you all. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and she is the justice who will meet with you today in discussing the case. Seated to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and on the farthest right is Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and to my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Pat Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our case 10AP1702, State v. Abraham C., and is it Negretti. And arguing on behalf of Mr. Negretti is Attorney Jeffrey W. Jensen. Counsel, you may proceed.
And if it pleases the court, opposing counsel, people in the gallery, I am Jeffrey Jensen, and I represent Abraham Negretti in this appeal. As I think the appellate process is designed to do, the issue that's before the court today has evolved from the time it started in the Washington County Circuit Court until we find ourselves here today. And so it's helpful for me to give a nutshell version of the procedural history. From there, I would like to describe for the court how I see the issue has evolved, and then I will suggest how those issues ought to be decided. Mr. Negrete pleaded guilty in May of 1992 to second-degree sexual assault of a child. He served his sentence, and in the year 2010, he found himself the subject of deportation proceedings. We attempted to get a transcript of the plea hearing from 1992, and we learned that the court reporter was deceased, the judge was retired, and defense counsel was also deceased. So Mr. Negrete, in March of 2010, filed a motion in which he alleged that at the time he pleaded guilty, he did not recall his attorney nor the court going through with him the immigration warning. He also alleged that had he been given the immigration warning, he would not have pleaded guilty.
Can I just back up and see if you can put a little meat on the bones for me about the deportation? Why was he being deported? What was alleged in the deportation as to the basis for his deportation?
I don't represent him in that. He has a different lawyer.
If it's not in the record, that's
okay.
Which I suspect.
My understanding is that the criminal conviction was serving as the basis for the deportation. In fact, I think while the petition for review was pending before the Supreme Court, he was arrested. My understanding, he's out now.
Let me ask you this, though, because when I read the statute, and this is a sticking point for me on this particular issue, and so you have to help me through this, and Ms. Burgundy, if I'm not going to ask the same question twice, so if you think of it, maybe you can address it too. In these kinds of proceedings, assume the court doesn't properly advise. Then the defendant has to show that the plea is likely to result in the deportation. And so in the motion before this court, what showing did the defendant, or before Judge Garner, what did the defendant show to show that his plea resulted in his deportation? Because his plea occurred 20 years ago.
Well,
so what about the plea resulted in his deportation, according to the statute?
The motion to withdraw the plea alleges in paragraph 4 that Negrete is now the subject of deportation proceedings, and I believe he also mentioned that in the affidavit.
I don't doubt that he was the subject, but was it his status of being an illegal alien that was the reason why he was being deported, or was it because of his plea 20 years ago? That's my question. So
right.
That's the I put it out there for you. You can do what you want
can
with
I,
it or nothing
right.
if you don't want to.
Well, then I think what I would like to do with that is point out that we never did get an evidentiary hearing, and certainly that would have been one of the main questions I would have asked Mr. Negrete.
But, I mean, to get one, you don't just make a motion and then the judge sets everything for a hearing. You have to allege certain things in your motion in order to get the hearing. So that's my question, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Right, and the only allegation was that Negrete is now the subject of deportation proceedings.
Okay.
Doesn't he say he believes that he didn't, doesn't recall?
Right.
What did he say?
He alleged in the affidavit and in the motion that I do not recall the court or my lawyer ever telling me of this consequence of the plea, but if there was any doubt about what he meant, it's fleshed out where he says, had I been told of the immigration consequences, I would not have pleaded guilty.
Right, and but that's the first part. So I'm saying, assume he wasn't properly advised. What in his motion says he's being deported because of the plea 20 years ago?
It does not specifically allege in the motion that Mr. Negrete is the subject of deportation proceedings because of the criminal conviction for sexual assault. I believe that to be the case based on my conversations with Mr. Negrete, but I will concede that is not in the motion itself.
Okay, thanks.
Counsel, what, if any, import does the relatively recent case of the United States Supreme Court, Padilla versus Kentucky, have with regard to this case? I know it's a Sixth Amendment case, but hearing the question, I pick up in Padilla, that was the same thing that was alleged as in his affidavit here, the defendant here. He alleged that he would have gone to trial had he not received, in Padilla, he received incorrect information.
Right.
In Padilla, his attorney told him, hey, don't worry, you won't be deported because you've been in the country so long. And there...
Very good advice.
Yeah, not very good advice. And so it went to court, the lower court in Kentucky, and they said, applying our long-time law of collateral consequences, deportation is a collateral consequence, not a direct consequence, like our law is in Wisconsin also, you know, not the sentence, not the probation, not the fine. It's a collateral consequence. Too bad, so sad. Goes to the Kentucky Supreme Court. They apply their same law of collateral consequences as we have here, essentially, and say, too bad, so sad. It has to be a direct consequence. The United States Supreme Court says, no, we are in a new world with this deportation issue. And on the very first page of the opinion, Justice Stevens, who wrote the opinion, takes the Kentucky court to task. Well, I shouldn't say taking it to task. It says, for not having an evidentiary hearing, he says, assuming the truth of the allegations, the Supreme Court of Kentucky denied Padilla post-conviction relief without the benefit of an evidentiary hearing. And then they go into talking about how because the drastic measure of deportation or removal is now virtually inevitable for a vast number of non-citizens, the importance of accurate legal advice for non-citizens of crimes has never been more important. And then talks about the matter of federal law, deportation law is an integral part of the penalty that may be imposed on non-citizens, etc. So, I mean, this is a case that's getting lots of national attention, and the ramifications of Padilla are the subject of many articles. What, if any, ramification does Padilla have today? It wasn't mentioned.
Padilla, as I understand it, was a Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel issue. And in State versus Chavez, which is the Wisconsin case that established that prejudice is an element of this claim, I think the last paragraph of Chavez, the court said, many states deal with this issue as an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. Prejudice is the second prong, and therefore we think the defendant ought to be required to show prejudice. Wisconsin, I think, has taken it one step further and given people even greater protection by putting it, making it incumbent upon the judge who's accepting the plea to advise the defendant in the exact words of the statute, which I think takes it beyond an ineffective assistance of counsel issue. And it'll play into one of the suggestions I will offer to the court about the procedure. And that is that when we get to the point where I'm talking about procedure, I think it should be incumbent on the state in cases of this class where prejudice is still an issue to show prejudice rather than the defendant to affirmatively prove that, allege that, and prove it as part of his motion. So I think we have greater protection thanks to the statute in Wisconsin. So I don't want to say Padilla doesn't apply because I can think of situations where it would apply, but I think we have greater protections here from the statute.
Counsel, in this matter, in its decision, the Court of Appeals wrote, Negrete initialed the box next to the clearly stated deportation warning on the plea waiver form and affixed his signature below a line reading, quote, I have read the entire document. I understand its contents, unquote. Negrete's lawyer signed the plea waiver form acknowledging that he discussed and explained the contents of it to Negrete, and that Negrete acknowledged his understanding of each item on the form. The Court of Appeals concluded, there is nothing for an evidentiary hearing to resolve. Negrete's, quote, does not recall, end quote, testimony does not in any way constitute a different historical basis, and there is, as a result, no disputed fact. So what is the disputed fact here?
Well, the disputed fact, Your Honor, is that Mr. Negrete not only alleged in his motion that he didn't recall his lawyer or the court ever giving him the immigration warning, but he also alleged in the motion that had he been given that warning, he would not have pleaded guilty. And I think that's an important additional fact that the Court of Appeals didn't give adequate consideration to.
What significance, if any, should it play in our consideration of this matter that your client's testimony is he does not recall, as opposed to an affirmative statement that he did not receive it?
There are three procedural approaches that the Supreme Court could settle on to direct the lower courts, and I think that'll answer your question, Justice Gableman. One would be the familiar Bangert procedure, where the defendant alleges that the plea colloquy was in some way defective and that he was confused by that, and then the burden shifts to the state.
But how does that apply here?
It doesn't apply. Okay. That would be one approach. So I agree, that does not really directly apply. The second approach would be the Nelson-Bentley approach, where the defendant alleges there was something outside of the plea agreement that confused him and made the plea not knowing and voluntary. That doesn't really fit either, because in most cases there will be a transcript, and here there wasn't a transcript. So I'm suggesting that the court craft a third procedure for these types of motions to guide the lower court. And the procedure would be the defendant, and I base this on the language of the statute, the procedure be that the defendant allege that he was not given the immigration warning, and the transcript either will show he was or he wasn't, or in the case of there being no transcript as here, then I think he's at least met his burden of having an evidentiary hearing.
But the first part of your standard, the first part of the rule you're asking us to craft starts with that he alleges he didn't receive the warning. Here he's not, it doesn't appear that he's alleging that. It appears he's alleging he does not recall.
And with all due respect, I think that's parsing the language of the motion too narrowly, because his statement that I don't recall my lawyer or the court ever giving me that warning, I think is an honest statement. I mean, to claim that you could remember verbatim what a judge told you some 20 years before, I think would be disingenuous. And he adds to that by saying, I wouldn't have pleaded guilty if I knew about that. And when you take those two things together, I think a fair inference to draw from that is he wasn't given it.
So your standard, your rule that you're asking us to craft would actually be something along the lines of when it is alleged, no matter whether it's a year, a decade, or two decades after the fact, not a positive assertion that it was not given. It could be, I don't recall. And that would be enough to shift the burden to the state to prove that it was?
Well, that kind of a rule would only apply to this narrow case of class of cases that we have here with Mr. Negrete, where there is no transcript. That's probably not a totally insignificant number of cases, but I would...
If there's no time limit, and the latches issue was discussed a little bit, but I expect that the length of time will come up in conversation. Where there is no time limit, it is not unlikely, it is not unforeseeable that there will be any number of times transcripts will not be available.
I agree wholeheartedly that it won't be an insignificant number of cases. And my answer to your question, Justice Gableman, is that yes, I believe if there is no transcript and the defendant alleges he doesn't recall being given the warning and he affirmatively alleges he wouldn't have pleaded guilty if he had been given such a warning, I think that is enough to trigger an evidentiary hearing. And then the second part of the rule that the court needs to craft is what extrinsic evidence is admissible to prove what the record would show if we had a transcript. I had a similar case recently where the transcript was not available. It was from the early 90s, and the trial judge in that case said, I know that I always read directly from the judicial bench book, and I believe I did it in this case. And based on that, the motion was denied. So in effect, the judge became a witness. The state suggested that the judge recuse himself, and he didn't. So when we talk about what rule this court, procedural rule, the court ought to craft, one of the main issues that needs to be resolved is what extrinsic evidence is admissible to prove what the transcript would have said if it were available. So I think that's an important issue.
Well, is the questionnaire that he initialed, is that intrinsic, extrinsic evidence that can be used?
I would like to say no, but in all candor, it probably is appropriate extrinsic evidence. I think the question gets much more sticky when we start talking about the judge being a witness, because there is, to me, something unseemly about a judge being a witness in the case in which he is making the finding of fact. How do I cross-examine the judge? And that was something that crossed my mind in that case, is how do I cross-examine the judge?
Well, didn't the circuit court and the Court of Appeals rely very heavily on this questionnaire, which your client signed, or I'm sorry, initialed, in which he said that he was advised and that the lawyer signed, and the lawyer said he advised him of all of this? And on the basis of that questionnaire, the trial court says, no evidentiary hearing for you. The Court of Appeals agreed.
That is exactly what the Washington County Circuit Court said and what the Court of Appeals also held, and that's why I'm here on a petition for review, because I think Mr. Negrete's allegations say more than that. I think there is an issue of fact, and if all that's required ever is a signed guilty plea questionnaire, then no judge in this class of cases would ever have to put the warning on the record.
Well, I see that you didn't cite, I think it's State v. Anderson. In that case, there was a colloquy about waiving a jury trial. And the colloquy was defective. The judge didn't say everything that was required in the waiver. But he did. The defendant there did sign a questionnaire similar, I think, to what your client signed. And the court said the questionnaire is not enough to overturn the transcript on its face was shown defective. The difference between your case and Anderson is here you don't have a transcript. So if you have a transcript, then the plea questionnaire is not good enough to avoid a Bangert hearing.
Right.
So the question is to what extent you can use that Anderson case to say when you don't have a hearing, you still need a hearing, when you don't have the transcript, you still need an evidentiary hearing, that you can't rely solely on the questionnaire to defeat the evidentiary hearing as key evidence.
Yes. And the problem is I know what Mr. Negrete's testimony would be on that point, but it's not part of the record because we didn't have an evidentiary hearing on that.
And that's all you're really asking for.
That's all we're asking for, that the relief we're asking for is an evidentiary hearing. But
and how many years after he pled guilty are you asking for this relief?
I believe it's approximately 18. It's probably close to 20 now.
Well, the state earlier relied on laches, and the Court of Appeals indicated they're not going to touch that issue, but it appealed to them.
It was a sound argument.
Argument, right. State doesn't argue laches here. Aren't there any statute of limitations? Isn't there a concept that you can't open up something 18 years? I mean, nothing becomes final. You have a murder trial, plea of guilty, 18 years later.
Right.
Guy's out of custody.
And I'm very grateful for the amicus brief that the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers filed, because I think that directly addresses that question. And the answer is there is no statute of limitations because, for one reason, the right to bring the motion doesn't ripen unless and until the person becomes a subject of immigration proceedings. Second of all, this is a...
You're saying it accrued recently.
Yes. Secondly, I believe this is an issue of law rather than equity, and as the amicus brief points out, latches is a defense only to claims of equity. And even if we do entertain this idea of latches, the state had the same notice that the plea was defective as the defendant did, so it's disingenuous to argue that we didn't know he was going to bring this claim. So I was going to suggest during my comments that the court do address the issue of latches, because I have a feeling, especially in the class of cases where prejudice isn't an issue, latches is going to come up all the time.
Counselor, you want us to address latches. How about 97402, which has a time limit on it for bringing this kind of motion?
Could I look at 97402 before I speak?
Of course, of course.
Make sure I know what it says. Well, if the time limit set forth in 97402 were applied to motions under 971.082, I think there's a conflict between the statutes then, because it would essentially gut the right to bring a motion to withdraw the plea anytime the immigration proceedings commence after the time limit under 97402 expires. So I would argue that that time limit either doesn't or at least should not apply to these kinds of motions.
Could I follow up on that? You certainly handle lots and lots of criminal cases. Are there no time limits at all on plea withdrawals?
There are two answers to that question, what the law says and what a creative criminal defense lawyer might try to argue to help his client. And I have certainly argued in cases several years later, maybe under a 974.06 issue or something of that nature, that this plea was not knowingly and voluntarily made. We're in the business of trying to work around time limits for our clients. But as a matter of what the law says, I do agree there's a time limit under 809.30. For making a post-conviction motion to withdraw a plea. There is a time limit under 974.02 for making a similar motion. But these issues come to us usually in very different forms. For example, we read the plea questionnaire or the plea colloquy, and it was completely defective. The defendant's time for appeal has expired, and then we would allege ineffective assistance of post-conviction appellate counsel for not raising the issue in a timely manner, and that's how we get in under 974.06. Well, I don't see any time limit on the immigration 971.08.
Okay, but under 974.06, you have a defendant in custody, and it seems to me there's going to be some latitude there when the defendant is in custody. Here we have a situation where the person has been out of custody for 18 years or so, and you're operating under 971.08 that isn't simply a plea withdrawal for this one. It refers to other plea withdrawals as well. So if you are able to say there are no time limits on 971.08, it seems to me there are no time limits on any plea withdrawal, and I think that is inconsistent with 974.02, which says a motion for post-conviction relief other than under 974.06 or 974.072 by the defendant in a criminal case shall be made in the time and manner provided in 809.30. I mean, it seems to me the implications of what you're asking here, Mr. Jensen, are very profound and go way beyond this case.
I agree that they are profound, and this is an issue that I think comes up in my own practice frequently, and I'm sure it comes up in the practices of other lawyers. And that's why I think the court probably accepted the petition for review, because we all need guidance from the Supreme Court about how to deal with this. But if the question to me is, do I think there should be some time limit, the answer is I vehemently disagree that there ought to be a time limit, and that's based both on equity and fairness reasons and also what I read in the statutes. The way I read 971.08 subsection 2, the right to bring the motion doesn't even accrue until the person becomes the subject of deportation proceedings. So anybody who becomes...
Wait a minute now. Are you saying you couldn't make this motion within, 60 days or whatever it is, right after the plea?
Well, in this case, Mr. Negrete couldn't have, because he didn't become the subject of deportation proceedings until well after all time limits had expired.
But he could have made a motion under Bankert if he had a transcript,
yeah.
Right?
I believe he certainly could have made a motion right. Under Bankert.
If he was still in custody, I wouldn't be raising these questions.
And I understand the question, but my answer is there are so many people in this state and probably across the country who are going to be the subject of deportation proceedings based on criminal convictions that are, in some cases, 18 and 20 years old, and to not give that person the opportunity to remedy the situation seems to me to be unfair. And that's why I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Negrete. It just does not seem fair that the federal government can wait all that time before they begin deportation proceedings, and the defendant is denied the benefit of this law that the legislature created. I understand the general concept of statute of limitations and why they're important. We need to have judgments be final. But, and I don't mean to sound flip, but then the federal government should set time limits on when they can use a criminal conviction as a basis for deportation, because then everything could get done according to the proper timetable.
Counselor, we are used to applying manifest injustice when someone asks us to determine they should be able to withdraw a plea. Doesn't he have to allege he's not guilty in order to satisfy that standard?
Not under the statute, he doesn't, but if I'm here begging for equity, I think that would be one of the things that we would need to raise.
Well, I'm just looking at, so you don't think that he has to allege that he's not guilty in order to satisfy manifest injustice and be able to withdraw the plea?
I don't think so, and I base my belief on the language of the statute and also this court's opinion in Duamala and State versus Legendoye, where this is a procedural protection, and if the immigration warning is not given in the exact words of the statute, that's it. The court has to allow the defendant to withdraw the plea. So I don't see any requirement that the defendant allege he's not guilty.
Chief, if I may.
Yes.
Counsel, in Duamala, interpreting the statute, it set forth three conditions that must be alleged. And in paragraph 25, it's dealing with the third condition. Third, both the state and the defendant agree that the defendant has shown the third condition, pursuant to 971.082, that the plea is likely to result in the defendant's deportation. The precise words of 971.082 lead inexorably to one conclusion in the present case. The circuit court must permit the defendant to withdraw the plea. So Duane Mala says the third condition is that the defendant has to show that he is, quote, likely to result, that the plea is likely to result in the defendant's deportation. How can someone assert that if no deportation proceedings have been commenced?
I know what the answer is in this question. In this case, it's because when Mr. Negrete came to me, he was aware of the fact that ICE was looking for him and wanted to talk to him, mm-hmm. and that's why he came to me. And I cannot represent to this court with any certainty that ICE had commenced any proceedings at the time he came to me. I have good reason to believe they have since commenced the proceedings because he was arrested.
Well, if I understand your argument, counsel, you're not arguing that anybody at any time 18 years later can withdraw his plea. We're only talking about people who are subject to deportation because of a plea.
Yes.
And that sub 2 says if a court fails to advise the defendant under the statute and a defendant later shows the plea is likely to result in the defendant's deportation, exclusion, etc., the court on the defendant's motion shall vacate any applicable judgment and permit the defendant to withdraw the plea, etc. Now, I was surprised that you didn't argue that 97108 is a statute. 80930 is both statutory but essentially a Supreme Court rule. So it would be limited to procedure, can't change substantive rights. I don't know whether 971.082 is substantive or procedural, and that may go back to Dwagmala and subsequent cases. And in 80930, it's not the time limits are not jurisdictional, as far as I know, and that the courts can extend it. And the courts of appeal, as I understand the practice, extend that time period with some frequency.
Well,
is that right or is that wrong?
I'm probably 300-0 in motions for extension, so I would say yes. It's fairly common for the court to extend. It's the one motion I always do if I need a victory. So, yes. If
that's a successful motion?
Yes, always, almost always.
If I could follow up on one of the chief's comments, I think you said that you're not advocating no time limits on all plea withdrawals. Only no time limits for this particular kind of plea withdrawal. Isn't the effect of what you're arguing that you could have completely defective plea colloquies where constitutional rights were not explained? Maybe even the right to an attorney or the right to a jury trial was never explained. The right for the judge to disregard recommendations from counsel on sentence. All of those rights are not as important as this right, that citizens can't assert things because of a time limit, but non-citizens can assert this right. Is that what you're arguing?
Well, that is what I'm arguing, but the basis for the argument is the statutes that the legislature and the governor created, because that's what they said. That's why I'm arguing it.
But with all due respect, you made a motion. Is that not correct?
Yes.
And you made it after a conviction.
It was after conviction, yes.
So it's post-conviction.
Correct.
Post-conviction motion.
Right.
Isn't that covered by the language of 97402?
Well, I don't think so, because if we were to apply 97402 to this situation, then the defendant would lose his rights before they ever even accrued. For example, if the time limit under 97402 expired and a week later the federal government decided to commence immigration proceedings, he would have lost his right before it ever accrued. That's why I think this is a different situation from denial of the right to counsel, other reasons for the plea not being knowing and voluntary, because there isn't a statute that specifically creates the right. I mean, there just is not a statute that says if the judge fails to give to go over the elements of the offense with the defendant, and the defendant shows this, he shall be allowed to withdraw his plea. There isn't a similar statute. The statute requires it, but you have to go through that Bangert procedure. And I believe under those circumstances, you would be subject to the time limits under 974.02, 809.30, and 974.06. If it wasn't timely raised, if there was good cause, it could be raised almost at any time.
Counselor, is your client in the country legally or illegally?
Again, I really hesitate to start making representations of fact like that to the Supreme Court when I don't represent him on that. What I know about it is that he is subject to deportation proceedings. I don't know exactly the reason why he's in the country, at least not well enough to make a representation to the highest court.
Thank you.
It 971.08 too doesn't make that a condition, legality or illegality.
Not that I can
see, no.
Subject
to deportation.
And I did, something occurred to me that I wanted to say in response to Justice Prosser's question. There is actually an institutional deadline on making these kinds of motions, because if a person becomes the subject of deportation and doesn't raise it, he will be deported and he'll be out of the country. And so there is sort of an institutional end line, you know, on these kinds of motions. I don't think.
But couldn't he be deported anyway if he's an illegal alien? That sort of is circular to me a little bit, isn't it?
I don't know whether he could be deported anyway. When I have these kind of issues, I bring in an immigration lawyer, so I don't know that well.
I'm not trying to put you in.
I see the red light is on and been on, so I will defer to counsel.
Thank you, counsel, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. And we have Sarah Burgundy, Attorney Burgundy, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin. Attorney Burgundy.
Your Honor, may it please the court and counsel, my name is Sarah Burgundy and I'm representing the State of Wisconsin. And like Mr. Jensen, I'd like to just start out by setting forth what the state sees as the issues in this case and how we see this opinion being written. First, this case demonstrates a need to clarify and enhance the prima facie pleading standards for situations where the defendant is attacking an older conviction based on a deficient plea colloquy and where there's no plea hearing transcript available. At a minimum, this court should clarify that under Bangert and Baker, a defendant needs to provide an affidavit establishing that there's no plea hearing transcript or court reporter notes.
Counsel, could you speak up just a little bit for me, please?
Yes, please. I will. So at a minimum, this court should clarify that under Bangert and Baker, a defendant needs to provide an affidavit establishing that there is no plea hearing transcript or court reporter notes describing efforts to otherwise reconstruct the plea hearing, and stating unequivocally that he or she did not receive the required portion of the colloquy. Additionally, given the absence of the transcript and the significant passage of time, this court may want to consider enhancing the pleading standard under these circumstances based on the Nelson-Bentley line of cases. Second, in any event, this court should affirm the Circuit Court and Court of Appeals. Under the circumstances here, Mr. Negrete's pleading does not meet the standards set forth in Bangert and Baker, because the factual basis of his claim is that he does not recall the court informing him of the immigration consequences of his plea.
Counsel? When I was preparing this, I wrote in my margin, in the margins, impossibility. And that is whether you look at Bangert or whether you look at this Chavez case, which was the precursor to Duangmala on this immigration stuff. And Chavez, in part was talking about Bangert, is my recollection.
Yes.
Just typical Bangert stuff is the defendant has to show a prima facie. First of all, I guess let me start with the statute. With regard to this particular warning or colloquy that the judge has to have with the defendant, there are some rights that the judge does not have to personally advise the defendant of. Good enough that the attorney can give him a plea questionnaire, and we have cases. But there are some rights, the legislature has indicated, the defendant has to be personally advised. And this is one of them, 97108, says that the court has to address the defendant personally and advise the defendant if you are not a citizen, etc. So this is one of those rights where the court has to be personally advised. The defendant has to be personally advised by the court. How can a defendant make a prima facie showing? Let's say Bangert applies. How can a defendant make a prima facie showing when it is impossible to obtain a transcript?
Well, under Bangert as it stands, and the Bangert test is that the defendant needs to identify a defect in the plea hearing, in the plea colloquy.
In the colloquy, yes.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And state that he did not know the information or did not understand the omitted or the deficient information. So under a strict reading of Bangert, if there's no transcript, if you can't point to a portion of the transcript, Bangert would seem to just not fit. We do have the State versus Baker, and that's really the only case applying the Bangert standard to a situation where there was no transcript. In that case, the defendant was challenging and operating after a revocation conviction that was about 4 years old in light of the sentencing scheme, which enhances a sentence for a later conviction. And in that case, he provided an affidavit stating that the legal secretary had contacted the court and they did not have a transcript, mm-hmm. and the court reporter notes had been destroyed, and an affidavit stating unequivocally that he did not, mm-hmm. I believe his challenge was that he didn't waive counsel, so he stated unequivocally that he never waived counsel. And this court held that that was enough. Now, I think what the state's position here is that that's an absolute minimum of what could be a prima facie pleading in these cases.
You started your comments, indeed, with that at a minimum there should be an averment that the transcript is unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
But my sense is, as we are all sitting here, having read the briefs and researched the law, that needing to aver that in an affidavit will not necessarily cause a case to rise or fall. Maybe for future instruction we will, but I mean, does that mean that 2 days after he gets a decision, if the decision were against him, he can bring it back in and then make that an averment and then it winds itself all the way back up? So I don't think it's going to be dispositive. It might be important or good practice or even a requirement in the future. It's not a requirement now. So what do you do when it's impossible, if you use the Bangert analysis, to meet the prima facie showing? Now, it's important because Bangert is clear. Once the prima facie showing is met, then the state has the burden. So the burden and who has to go forward on this kind of issue is also important. What do you do with impossibility?
Well, I think, as we stated, if Baker's setting forth a minimum, you know, I think both sides have hands tied in this case. The defendant can't make a prima facie. It's difficult for a defendant to make a prima facie showing if there's no plea hearing transcript. If he can make such a prima facie showing, it's going to be extremely difficult on the state, once the burden shifts, to be able to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that the plea was otherwise knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Mm-hmm. And so what do we do?
I know, that's really difficult.
That's the question.
it's not perhaps impossible. I mean, we have here the unfortunate situation where the court reporter is dead, the defense attorney is dead. I don't know about the prosecutor. If the prosecutor, assuming a prosecutor was at the hearing, if the prosecutor is still around, the judge is no longer on the bench. I don't know if there are other witnesses who were there, and that I don't mean to suggest it's not a burden. But it is legally a burden also. You know?
Sure, and I don't know if we can provide an entirely satisfactory answer to that question because I think it's an impossible question in some ways.
Well, what does the state want? Does the state want to say 18 years, too late, too bad, so sad? Right?
No.
I mean, that's, you can do that. 18 years is too long. Does the state want to say no evidentiary hearing because there's a questionnaire? There's no transcript here, but there is a questionnaire that's good enough to forestall an evidentiary hearing. Could say that. I mean, that's what the Court of Appeals and trial court said.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what the state's position is? Does the state, what do we do with this kind of case? 18 years, no transcript, no judge's apparently recollection or notes, no defense counsel's gone. We don't know if there's an assistant DA who has notes that he might have or she might have kept for 18 years. Not likely, but maybe. What do we do? What does the state want the court to do?
The state has, in response to that, I would say we have about a four-step approach here.
Okay.
First step, enhance the pleading standards under Bangert.
But when you say, I heard that, enhance the pleadings, do you mean that they have to allege no transcript?
Yes.
Do they have to allege no trial judge, no defense counsel?
No defense counsel.
No prosecutor able to testify?
Yes.
Okay.
And also address the court reporter notes, which may seem like overkill if there's no transcript, but if generally when a defendant pleads guilty or pleads no contest, he also limits the number of ways he can appeal a case. And if he doesn't appeal, the transcript's not necessarily created. Now, under Supreme Court rules, court reporter notes are kept within the court for 10 years, and then they're authorized. The court's authorized to destroy them at that point. So we can kind of see where the intersection of these missing.
And they may or may not have been destroyed here.
They may not have been. The court I talked to said that the reporters are on top of it. That it's and it probably depends on the resources of the individual court.
So they were destroyed here.
They were destroyed here.
Okay. So enhance the pleadings. Okay. Do you want that retroactive to this case?
That's a difficult question. I think the short answer is it would be unfair to expect Mr. Jensen or Mr. Negrete to have anticipated a higher pleading standard when he entered the motion, so no.
But as a matter of fact, apparently these have all been complied with, apparently.
As of these requirements?
No.
Well, and the other addition is an affirmative statement that he.
Okay, so that is that part of your enhanced the pleadings, or is that a second? Okay.
That's part of the enhanced.
So affirmatively say didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
So saying I can't remember, but I know I wouldn't have pled if I knew I'd be deported or subject to deportation is not enough.
That's not enough.
Okay.
The second sort of part of it is, as the Court of Appeals found, if there is no, basically if there's no other evidence other than what is here or what's in a sort of narrow situation, if we have a otherwise trustworthy plea hearing transcript against the defendant's word that he doesn't recall the hearing, or I'm sorry, he doesn't recall receiving the warning, a hearing is not necessarily warranted under those circumstances if the court need not, he isn't necessarily entitled to a hearing.
You're saying that the Court of Appeals doesn't, that the trial court doesn't have to give a hearing unless there's this affirmative allegation.
Right, and this is sort of, and not to confuse the, this court's drawn pretty strict lines between the Bangert and the Nelson-Bentley line of cases, and at the risk of, I don't want to confuse those two lines, but this is a little bit like the second step of Nelson-Bentley, where the court considers whether the motion alleges sufficient facts, whether it makes simply conclusory statements, and whether the record demonstrates as a whole he's not entitled to relief. In those cases, the court can nevertheless decide not to have, excuse me, the court can decide to not have a hearing in those situations. Third step, and onto the timing issue, and I acknowledge this is not something that we briefed, and the reason for that is because, in our view, this record is not developed to be able to make a decision on timing. We do agree with Mr. Jensen to the extent that under 971.082 claims are likely to not become ripe until deportation proceedings are underway or the defendant attempts to get naturalization and is denied, or some event like that. So under these circumstances here, we have no idea when the deportation proceedings began, and there's just no other evidence that would enable the court to be able to apply any timing rule it came up with. Now, that being said, we don't concede that latches is never applicable, as the amicus says, amicus brief sets forth. We don't think it's as simple as it sets forth.
So do you want an allegation that they're subject to deportation or subject to some INS proceedings that will be deleterious to him because of the conviction?
Yes.
So that has to
I didn't quite follow your response to the second most recent question from the Chief Justice. When, in the state's estimation, does the right for someone in Mr. Negrete's position, when does the right accrue to bring this challenge? Under what circumstances?
Okay, let me back up. Actually, the right accrues after he gives the, I mean, technically he has the right after giving the plea, but there's a fair chance that a number of defendants would not become aware of the deportation consequences until they're actually subject to deportation proceedings. And so because of that, the timing issue is a little tricky.
That's why I'm asking.
Okay.
So when does it accrue?
It accrues, in the state's view, when the deportation proceedings are commenced, or when the defendant first gets notice that he's subject to deportation.
So he can't bring one 90 days after he's pled?
He may not.
Nothing else happens. He has no right to do that under the statute?
The distinction between whether he has a right to do so or not is, it's possible that he would not, that would not happen within 90 days.
I understand that. I question you further because of your use of the word accrue.
Right.
Which is kind of legalese for there's no right until some event occurs. So,
okay. And I'll retract that language to the extent I'm saying there's no right within 90 days or there's no right. I think the event that we want to consider in determining timing or whether there's some sort of timing bar on the claim is the date that the federal government brought proceedings.
Counsel, I almost think that you and Mr. Jensen are saying the same thing, and if you are, I need to know that. What I hear Mr. Jensen saying is, if my client alleges that he was not given these warnings, 20 years later he can withdraw a plea, because if he is then subject to deportation, the assumption should be made that the deportation is because of his plea 20 years previous. I mean, it isn't because of a conviction, because you don't get this warning if you're convicted after trial, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's irrelevant. You can still be deported because you've been convicted of any offense, but convicted of a sex offense, but you could be deported because you're an illegal alien as well, right?
Correct.
So it isn't tethered to a criminal conviction. It strikes me this plea is tethered to the idea, gosh, I didn't know I could be deported if I entered a plea. I want my trial instead. I want to go to trial and have my day in court, and if the state can prove me guilty, fine. But if they can't, you know, I want my day. Now, someone in this particular defendant's position, he got a great deal. I mean, probation for a sex offense, you know, second degree sexual assault of a child, was that what it was?
Yes.
And he gets probation. He has zero incentive, in my mind, after entering the plea, to appeal that. Because he doesn't want to stay in court. He doesn't want a trial. He wants the deal. And he got the deal. So then 20 years later, when he's being deported, because presumably, I mean, you can't deport someone just because they're convicted of a crime. They have to be in the country without the authority to be in the country. They have to be an illegal alien, right? I mean, they have to be here illegally to be deported. So it's not because of the conviction that he's deported. It's because of his status as an illegal alien that he's being deported. So what incentive is there? I mean, if the whole purpose of the statute, and I agree with it, if you, as a judge, take a plea and the person really doesn't know what they're doing, and they shouldn't have entered a plea, and they deserve their day in court and they deserve to have a trial, you ought to let them withdraw the plea. But where's the fairness in saying you pled from the plea questionnaire, and otherwise it seems like it was an otherwise knowingly free and voluntary plea. In order to accept the plea, the judge has to say, I find that you've knowingly, freely, and voluntarily pled. There's a plea questionnaire where they specifically, at least in this one, it may not work the same currently, but they initial next to this warning saying, you know, and they sign the bottom, and the judge goes through that, presumably, if the plea questionnaire is in, and he's pled guilty and he gets the deal that he cut, and then 20 years later, it finds out he's being deported. Then that person should be able to withdraw their plea and have their trial. I mean, really, the police, possibly retired, who knows where the victim is. I mean, in reality, you're saying for certain people who are in the status of being in the country illegally and are deported because of conviction, all they have to do is allege that the judge didn't give them this warning, and then they can go back and be in the position of state prove your case 20 years later. Is that really what you intend to have the court do? Because when I read the language of the statute, which is where I started, and I really would like you to address it, assume the warning wasn't given. That's sub two. Assuming that there was a failure to advise, what does it say has to happen? The defendant has to show that the plea is likely to result in the deportation. It doesn't have to show that the plea resulted in deportation. The plea is likely to result in deportation. So it doesn't set forth the standard that you have just said, which is the deportation proceedings have to commence. So I'm struggling with the language of the statute and trying to actually, you know, show deference to what the legislature wrote in the statute and what trial courts have to determine in order to give someone their day, an evidentiary hearing, and allow them 20 years later to withdraw a plea. And what you've said, you think the test should be. Because basically you've said, so long as they allege it, they get a hearing. And that's kind of what Mr. Jensen has said. And if that's really what you think, how do you marry that to the statute?
And to not correct an earlier statement, but just to actually step back, I'm not clear based on immigration law that my understanding of immigration law is that someone who is in the country on a green card or otherwise legally in the country, if he has an aggravated felony, he can be deported on the basis of that. So he's not necessarily illegal in the country per se. It is the plea that actually triggers the deportation.
And that's fine, but it's that defendant's burden under the statute to show that it was the plea that was likely to result in the deportation. That's his right.
Correct.
I mean, isn't that the explanation? It's not my status as an illegal alien. I'm here legally,
And that because the plea, now I'm being deported. Now, if we had that, that's a different story, because then that's met. But I'm not seeing that anywhere.
And they're not, and back to your original question about what is that, you know, what's the import of that language? Is the plea likely to result in deportation? The Court of Appeals addressed that language in two cases, and unfortunately I seem to bring everything from my office except the cites to those two cases, but they are Beza, it's spelled B-A-E-Z-A, and Bedoya, it's spelled B-E-D-O-L-L-A. And those courts have treated that language fairly minimally. They've basically looked at the charge pled to. They looked at the immigration statute that says we will deport you based on an aggravated felony. Looked at that. Does that fit an aggravated felony? It does. There's a federal statute that also says any of these offenses.
So it might as well not be in there, is what you're saying. The language is meaningless so long as you say you weren't given the warrant.
Based on Beza and Bedoya, it's not given a lot of import. In fact, in Bedoya, the defendant was subject to deportation based on two charges. He was only seeking plea withdrawal on one, and that court said it's irrelevant that there's some other reason, basically, that there's this other charge, because what's alleged here is the defect in the plea colloquy on this specific charge, and that's basically how that language has been treated. And there's reason for that. Looking at the legislative history of 97108, it suggests that the legislature had a concern with requiring defendants to reveal their immigration status at the time of the plea or any time before the federal government initiates proceedings. So there's, in part, the language of the statute sort of fits in with that it just sort of gives this, if you later show it's subject to deportation, it's just.
So if I hear you correctly, it doesn't matter that language is in there because it's meaningless?
I think all it does is it ensures that a defendant who is an American citizen who claims that he didn't get the deportation warning can't then go ahead and enter, you know, can't go ahead and do a 97108-2 motion because, you know, if that language is gone, that would sweep in every defendant. The warning needs to be given to every defendant. So what that language does is it simply limits people who are able to bring the 97108-2 claims to people that are subject to deportation. So people just not born in the United States or otherwise defined under federal law. Does that answer your question, Justice Ziegler? I'm sorry.
Sure. It's not what it says.
It's not terribly satisfactory, but that's what we have.
Okay, thank you.
When in your four-point regimen does the burden shift to the state or doesn't it?
The four-point regimen, I like that. Basically, if the defendant makes a prima facie showing under the first step, the court reviews it and determines that he's entitled to a hearing under second step, then the burden would shift to the state to demonstrate that the plea was otherwise knowing and intelligent and voluntary.
And how does the state satisfy that burden?
Basically, at a hearing. As I noted, the hands of both sides are tied in these cases, and so the state at that point can bring forth evidence. It could be an affidavit from the judge stating that, you know, most likely it'll be a statement that's, you know, I don't remember this particular case, but I'm in the habit of delivering the warning. It could be someone else that was at the hearing. It could be extrinsic evidence of the defendant's knowledge of the deportation proceedings at the time. This case in particular, we've said over and over, is rather narrow because not only is there no transcript, but there's really nothing else. There's no one else other than Mr. Negrete who can apparently testify at a hearing. The case of the missing transcript is going to come up again, and there's going to be broader cases, but there's examples in the case law and the Chavez line of cases of other evidence that's come up. For example, defense attorney discussing the process that he or she went over in filling out the plea questionnaire. their California case is talking about basically the judge's affidavit, as I mentioned before. So it's not impossible. It is, but the state acknowledges it is difficult.
Do we know who the prosecutor was here?
Yes. I don't know off the top of my head, but that's information that's findable. And I haven't. Yeah, I don't know who it is. I mean, and that's not in the record of who that is or if anyone discussed the matter with
him. It's on an available court docket. Is that right?
Excuse me?
The information as to who is the prosecutor is available on a court docket sheet.
Yes.
Which is still in existence.
That still exists, and we can trace back who we know who the judge was. The judge is retired. The court reporter's death really doesn't have anything to do with the availability of the transcript per se, but, you know, that would be somebody that ostensibly could testify at a hearing on these matters.
Ms. Burgundy, you want the Court of Appeals decision affirmed. How would you write the decision here?
Well, as I started out discussing the problem that we have with the Bangert pleadings in these cases and kind of taking the four-step, not the four-step approach. I didn't get to the fourth step, but that's
what
sort
is
of,
it?
It's actually, the fourth step is sort of a side consideration, and that's basically, I think, the best way to address these cases is to limit them as much as we can. And that way, talking about ways of maybe changing Supreme Court rules as to when court reporter notes are destroyed, talking about rules for when plea hearing transcripts are created, when they must be maintained, things like that. I think the coming storm is going to occur when we get into the line of Dwagmala cases where when a defendant simply makes a prima facie showing that he's entitled to prima facie showing that he didn't get a warning, plea withdrawal is automatic, and that case is now 10 years old, and this year those court reporter notes are going to start being destroyed, and we're going to start seeing more of these cases. So fourth step is more of a prophylactic effort to...
Well, what's the essence of how you would write this opinion? I understand your four-point regimen, if you will, as described earlier, but you want the Court of Appeals affirmed.
Correct.
The Court of Appeals said... no evidentiary hearing here. How would you address that?
I think basically address it as the Court of Appeals did, essentially. Say Mr. Negrete did not make a prima facie showing under Bangert and Baker. Even if he did, in this narrow case, here's the evidence we have before us. We have testimony that I don't recall the getting the warning versus a plea waiver form that has the exact language of the statute, has his initial next to the statute indicating his understanding. It has a paragraph at the end that he initialed indicating that he understands the entire thing. It's attested by his attorney, who's an officer of the court, saying that I reviewed everything with my client. I believe he understands it. There's no other evidence that he doesn't understand written English or he can't speak English. That's actually another part of the plea waiver form. And when we have that sort of evidence absent anything else, that essentially there's no question of fact that makes an evidentiary hearing necessary.
Ms. Burgundy, section 971.08 sub 2 tells us that if a court fails to advise a defendant as required in sub 1, that is about the deportation possibility, and the defendant later shows that the plea is likely to result in the defendant's deportation, exclusion from admission, et cetera, then there's an entitlement to plea withdrawal. Now, the two cases you cited in response to Justice Eagler's questions following my questions about the accrual of the right to seek the relief Mr. Negrete is now seeking, you cited two cases, Beze and Bedolla. Beze is 174 with second 118. Bedolla is 295 with second 410. in the capture, the summary that I get in the statutes from the DOLA tells us that sub 2 uses the term likely and not shall, meaning the defendant need not prove he definitely will be deported as a result of the case in question. So I don't, in light of that, I don't see how these cases, I don't have the cases themselves in front of me, but what are you, what is your position about what these cases instruct us as to the accrual of the right to bring the motion?
My understanding of the DOIA is that that statement's correct, and that it means we're not going to put a burden on the defendant to demonstrate that deportation proceedings are going to be successful. All that he needs to show is that he has a qualifying felony that that would satisfy the deportation requirements, which actually would mean before any deportation proceedings have begun, if he learns from other sources that he's subject to deportation under INS rules, technically he could bring a motion seeking plea withdrawal at that point. And I think your point, I think it raises a question that, again, because we haven't really briefed this fully and gone through it, it's a complicated issue because of the legislative intent behind 97108 to prevent defendants from revealing their immigration status before the federal government brings proceedings. And I think there's a tension there.
So it seems to me, just based on this very superficial, by definition, reading of the annotation following the statute, that someone in Mr. Negrete's situation must not, by definition, be required to wait until the institution of deportation proceedings to bring such a motion.
I would say, and I guess under, if we were to establish some sort of timing provision, you know, in this three-step regimen, if we're going to look at timing, whether it's a latches argument or in the past we've made kind of a due diligence argument, there may be some sort of limitation to if it can be established that Mr. Negrete or another defendant in his position knew years before that this felony was going to cause the federal government to bring immigration proceedings, that would kind of go into a timing, you know, that might shorten the timing period that the court would otherwise set.
But all of which highlights the potential, as Mr. Jensen described it earlier and you alluded to, of the possibility of the right expiring prior to the accrual of the right to bring it.
If I may, one of the things that you focused on is your, I think, second step of what he should be saying here in his affidavit. In the affidavit, he said, "I don't recall the court or my lawyer ever telling me of the consequences of the plea." If he had said instead, "I don't believe that the court personally told me of the consequences of the plea," would that satisfy you? Would he then be entitled to the evidentiary hearing under Bangert?
No, because I don't, I'm now engaging in the non-equivocal language as well, because that doesn't provide an unequivocal statement. There's a large class of defendants that can truthfully say, "I don't remember, I don't recall, I don't think I mm-hmm. this happened, I'm not sure that this happened." In the interest of limiting this to defendants who truly did not get the warning, the state's just putting forth that they need to demonstrate unequivocally, "I know I did not get it."
But to me, my concern is this, that it almost encourages lying. You sit as a circuit court judge and you have this train of defendants coming in on plea day and entering a plea and you have them scheduled 10 minutes apart and hope that they take five, but you have them scheduled 10 minutes apart. For someone 18 years later to be able to say with certainty, "I
recall, the judge told me about that deportation warning. It doesn't meet with reality, given the volume that's going on and what's going on. It may for some, but for many, it won't. And so, what are they to do? I mean, this seems to me to be awfully honest. Mm-hmm. You could have fudged it a little more and got it closer to, I didn't get it. You know, I believe I didn't get it. Obviously, he believes it because he says, had I known it, I would not have entered a plea. How do you do? You don't want to suborn perjury.
No, and we're not encouraging lying, and we're not accusing, you know, I believe Mr. Negrete when he says he doesn't recall the proceedings or doesn't recall getting the warning. But I think under those circumstances, a defendant can say, I know I didn't get the warning, and here's why. A number of reasons. I specifically talked to my attorney about my concerns about being deported, and he assured me otherwise. I had a conversation with my wife about it. We talked about the, you know, there's, if someone is truly later being subject to deportation proceedings and completely caught unaware, it seems likely that there could be other information that he could provide in the affidavit explaining exactly why he knows he didn't get it.
Well, defense counsel said that's what he did. He said, if I had gotten the warnings, I wouldn't have pled because mm-hmm. I would be deportable. And that tells me that, although I don't remember if I got them or not, that I didn't get them because that would have triggered a response of let's not do that plea. I mean, that's what he's saying.
And in the state's view, there's more needed. It has to be more than, you know, ultimately we've called the statement, I wouldn't have pled otherwise, a conclusory statement, and without any other facts saying, okay, well, why not, especially in light of, you know, you took a plea, you're an unsympathetic defendant.
You know what's missing in response to your answer to Justice Crooks, from my perspective? What are the criteria, the triggering factors that will give them an evidentiary hearing? I mean, the judge has to make a decision. You get an evidentiary hearing, you don't, mm-hmm. right? I don't know if it's discretionary or a matter of law, but that's what the judge has to decide. So what here, or what in any case, are the triggering facts that say to the judge, no hearing? Now, one is the pleadings, in your view, are bad. Okay. If that's it, then do you give them an opportunity to replead? Well, motions aren't pleading, but do you give them an opportunity to restate the motion? And there are cases that say when there's a motion and the allegations aren't good, the judge can allow that. So, okay, the allegations. But as you stated, all of the allegations really have been, although not averred, have been met here. So can't be just the allegations. So what here triggers no hearing? Is it the questionnaire? Is that what triggers no hearing? What are the triggers here?
I think, and again, this is a very narrow set of circumstances, but when we have an otherwise trustworthy questionnaire and simply a statement that I don't recall the hearing, there's no question of fact raised. And so if there's anything else, if anybody can show that there's anything else that could come in and affect it and raise a question of fact, then that would trigger the hearing.
You know, the affidavit of the judge or prosecutor, unless there's something about this case that's so dynamic that it stood out after 18 years, is going to say, my usual practice is I followed the bench book. And then I ask, can you assure us that you never deviated? And the judge, if he's going to be honest, is going to say, no, I can't assure that. I can merely say that's my practice. That's the way I usually did it. And I therefore assume that's what I did here, right? Mm-hmm. That's all the judge or the prosecutor most likely can say, mm-hmm. which is the same thing as the defendant is saying, hey, I can't remember what If they gave it to me, I would have protested.
Sure. But at that point, it's a credibility question.
But that's a hearing. Mm-hmm. That's a hearing.
But if that other part isn't there, then there's no hearing necessary. So,
are there any questions? Justice Prosser has his hand up.
As I understand it, you're talking a little bit about accrual of the right to make this motion, depending on the commencement of a deportation hearing. Maybe you want to state that differently, but the statute also talks about denial of naturalization. It seemed to me that a defendant is the one who initiates an effort to become a naturalized citizen.
Mm-hmm.
That can be done at any time.
Sure. And I, to the extent that I'm making a statement that the right doesn't accrue until the proceedings begin, I retract that. The reason I'm discussing when the proceedings begin is that that's more the triggering moment for any sort of timing consideration of when late is too late. It doesn't affect, I'm not saying that that is, affects the defendant's right to actually bring a claim, and I want to clarify that. The defendant could bring the claim. I mean, he could enter the plea the next day, learn of the deportation consequences, and file the 971-082 motion the next day. It's more, and I apologize for the confusion over. It goes more to the question of timing. If this court adopts a rule installing a time bar on these sort of motions, that would be one relevant consideration. And if this court does decide to remand for an evidentiary hearing, that would be evidence that would be relevant to be brought up then.
Did you also send a message to the court that perhaps we ought to reconsider the length of time that we keep notes for the creation of transcripts, at least with respect to cases that might involve people who were subject to the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. And that the court rule is
an SCR rule.
SCR 72.
On retention of records.
Exactly. Whether that's something the court, you know, it's something the court, I believe, should consider. And obviously other people are going to have input as to the cost and that sort of thing.
State going to bring a petition to change that rule?
We're going to consider it, yes. Like I said, I think, you know, the step four of this process is preventing this from happening as much as possible. So
the issue of how long records should be retained has arisen before, and I can't remember what the exact circumstances was, but whether the length is too short or too long, depending on particular cases. But let me just clarify something in response to questions from Justice Prosser. Within weeks of the conviction and the plea, this defendant could have brought a motion that, with a transcript, that there was a defective plea colloquy because this information was not given.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Correct.
Nothing to do whether he's going to be deported, because that would be a straight banger. Right?
Correct.
So he doesn't have to wait until he's threatened with deportation. But if he doesn't do it within that time frame and within the Bangert usual proceeding under 97406 or 02, then if 18 years elapse, he falls under the other provision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're debating now.
Mm-hmm.
What are his rights under 97108 sub 2?
Mm-hmm. No, was there a question? Well,
because you say, well, it didn't accrue until the deportation, but that's not quite right.
And
it
that's
accrues
not, and I,
instantly.
It accrues instantly. I think for a question of a timing rule, that would be relevant information.
That's right. And for this case, it's not the usual timing. It comes
exactly
under 2, sub 2.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, unless
thank
there
you
are questions from the court.
I don't hear any.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Jensen.
I think I finally understand the questions that I got from Justice Ziegler. I'm not sure I understood them the first time around. The question, as I understand it now, is whether the language in the statute which reads likely to result in deportation is a question of law or a question of fact or maybe a mixed question. It would be a question of law if we said second-degree sexual assault of a child is a deportable offense, and therefore the day after he entered his plea, he would likely to be deported. But I don't think it's strictly a question of law because the statute could have said if the defendant shows that he wasn't given the immigration warning and he pled guilty to a deportable offense, then we'd have a time limit. But that's not what the statute says. If it were strictly a question of fact, then you may have to interview the ICE agent or the ICE attorney who filed the pleadings to say, I was motivated by this conviction, this plea, and I alleged it in the pleadings. And I really don't think that was the intention either. So I think it's a mixed question of law and fact. Is this a deportable offense? And have deportation proceedings been started? I think that is what I understand the question to be, and that's the issue that the court will have to decide. And my suggestion is that it is a mixed question of law or fact.
If he pled in 92, and let's just say he was given the maximum, was it a 10-year maximum then for this offense?
Yes.
That's what it says in the plea questionnaire.
I believe
that
that's correct.
Right?
I didn't look
so
it up.
So if the court, instead of giving him probation, gave him the maximum, he could have served,
10 years.
At
or
most,
so.
Right. And so then 8 years after that, he's deported. Does there have to be some sort of nexus?
Well, I think there does have to be a nexus that the deportation was as a result of the conviction for the second-degree sexual assault.
Do you think that factors in at all, that it didn't ever happen even within the possible maximum sentence of that offense, that it was almost two times the maximum sentence before they ever initiated deportation proceedings? Does that make any difference as to?
I don't know if it's a law or if it's just a policy of the Department of Justice, but my experience with my clients is they do not get deported while they're serving a prison sentence.
Right.
Otherwise, everybody, we'd always go in and say, just agree to immediate removal and you'd never have to go to prison.
Right, but I mean, this isn't even within the possible sentence. What did he get?
I think it's correct. He got probation.
Okay. But even assuming, that sentence was, when was the probationary sentence over?
A long time ago.
18 months.
Yeah. So it was 18 months from 1992. So even assuming it's 1994, so he's deported in 2010 for an offense that he was off paper on in 1994, roughly.
Yes.
Okay.
And the other point I wanted to address is I agree that the practicing lawyers who have these people come in to his office with these problems do need guidance on what we're supposed to put in the pleadings. So there is this need for instruction from the Supreme Court, but I really beg the court not to create a requirement that we allege in an affidavit that I know for a fact I wasn't given the immigration warning, because what will happen is the unscrupulous defendants and the unscrupulous lawyers will always get their hearing, and the scrupulous defendants a lot of times will be denied a hearing, because let's face it, we have a court reporter because none of us can remember exactly what was said during the course of proceedings. If we all could remember that, we wouldn't need court reporters or recordings or anything. So I ask that not to be a requirement.
But doesn't the defendant in a Banger-type motion have to allege, I didn't understand. Here's the transcript. There's a defect in the transcript. I didn't understand.
Right. I think that's a little bit of a different situation. Let's say, for example, the judge did not explain the elements of the offense. It's in the record because it's a Banger motion. We can see in the transcript, sure enough, the judge did not give the elements of the offense. And then the defendant, I think, can truthfully say, I didn't understand the elements of second-degree sexual assault, and then the burden shifts to the state to say, oh, yes, you did, and here's why we think you did, because your lawyer attached the jury instructions to the plea questionnaire and so on and so forth. I think that's different than requiring somebody to say, I know for a fact Judge so-and-so did not give me the elements of the offense. Were the transcripts not available?
Counsel, I don't have the Badala case with me, but I do have State versus Baez, which is a 1993 case. You have to be careful about that case. It's before Padilla. They get all involved in direct and collateral consequences. And it's before the statute, so Bangert doesn't apply. But this case, and I'll look at the other one, says whether he is entitled to withdraw his guilty plea pursuant to 97108 involves interpretation of that statute and its application to the facts which were presented to the court. This presents a question of law, which we decide without deference to the trial court's decision. So as I am citing Wilson, which I haven't read. So at least at that case, it was a question of law as to likely. And then the court says, they looked at 18 U.S.C. 16b and said he's conclusively presumed deportable because the crime must have been listed there. This conclusive presumption, especially when coupled with his testimony, he was under a deportation hold was being investigated by INS, is sufficient to show he is likely to be deported. I mean, that's coming in. Because he couldn't come in under Bangert there because of the timing for all the statutes. So I call that to your attention.
And I think that in my mind, shows that it ought to be a mixed question of law and fact. Otherwise, we go back to Padilla, where it was a deportable offense, but the lawyer says, don't worry about it. They don't come after you for that, which is bad advice, because sometimes they do.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both Mr. Jensen and Ms. Burgundy for excellent arguments on a very difficult legal issue and the issue of the instructions that are required by, the warning and admonition that is required by the legislature have come to the court a number of times. And here's another one. That ends our argument in 10-AP-1702, State versus Negrete. The court has concluded its February arguments as scheduled. Justice Bradley will come out to talk with the students, and the court will meet in a closed conference at 1:30 with a long lunch, unless you all want to meet at 1. We'll meet at 1:30, closed conference. We are adjourned for the oral. It's yours.